Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Brother Calvin. This edition of Trillion Dollar Flow. We're going to go into Ponzi schemes. Ponzi schemes and financial scams that weighs on us spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. Okay, this episode of Trillion Dollar Flow is brought to you by the Seed of Abraham Ministries, helmed by Bishop T. Turner. You can reach him at his website, which is theseedofabraham.yolasite.com, or you can give him a call at 773-577-9720. If you can't reach him by phone, go to his Contact Me page on his website and put your information in his Contact Me page, and you hit the button and go to his email instantaneously. He gets it from his phone and get back with you in a timely fashion. Okay, now, with all that, let's get into it. Now, I got to say this. The only way to have true abundance is to maintain it if everyday people, men and women and children, work together to share and contribute to each other's well-being. It can be worked out in small groups to large groups, but the goal is work together to achieve greatness and oneness of spiritual purpose. Our greatest riches is our souls, our minds, our hearts, and our bodies. With those four, we can beat the world and get anything that we need. Now, I had to say that. Basically, the art of the Ponzi scheme. The Ponzi scheme was created, and the father of the Ponzi scheme, as we know here in America, is by Charles Ponzi. And what he did was taking a lot of people's money, promising them postal stamps. And he had so much money, he was like, it was ridiculous. He started the whole scheme. You know, I'm not going to go into the details of him, but that was around 1921. He was selling coupons for postage stamps. The Ponzi scheme, as we see it, is basically detailed as, basically, you have companies or individuals promising people big returns on their money, that their money is safe, that if they invest with them, they'll bring them back a certain amount of money back, or they'll be able to pull money out of the account. Pretty much investment accounts, basically. You put your money, you believe in the person because the person knows how to work the money. He promised to bring, or the corporation promised to bring you results by lending out your money, making risky bets, lending money to certain people, that you get a certain percentage back. That goes that goes into people trusting. Now, usually, I would say, on the surface, it looked like it's a very cool thing to do. But what we have right now is this big epidemic of Ponzi schemes that's going on in corporate America, in the banking industry. All the way, we can go all the way to Enron with the energy company, saying that they're making so much money, and when you come to find out, they had no money. People lost their life savings. People didn't get their 401k from the company. They were just totally busted. A lot of people was hurt by that. Then you had the Arthur Anderson, who was covering it, which was an accounting firm that covered that mess up. They got busted. They had a run on their books because they were hiding the money for Enron. So they had a collapse. But they had to change the name, and a lot of people was hurt like by that. I had a friend, personal friend, who worked for Arthur and Anderson. I mean, he must have had a heart attack about it. But he was constantly assuring me that it was a good company, but yet news was coming out how they were like shredding documents, hiding the true figures of Enron and all this other stuff. There was nothing that he could say. That he worked for a company that was fraudulent. To him, it blew him away. But right now in corporate America, and you gotta watch yourself. You gotta watch where you invest your money. You gotta watch where you how you trust people. People just trust people. There's people that runs Ponzi schemes financially. People that run spiritual Ponzi scheme to get you to look up to them, to listen to them spiritually, and then everything they're talking about is positioning you to be in spiritual, financial, mental, and emotional ruin. You gotta pay attention. Then you got this other company called Pedigree. It's a futures company. This guy, Woodruff, he misappropriated about $215 million in his customers' money. And he was going into their accounts over a span of 20 years, raping their accounts, taking money off. This is what this guy was doing. He's a CEO. He was the only one. He owned the company right out. He had something like 200 workers. He did this. Now you would think that these cats would stop. Then you have Charter Bank. That's a whole thing with them money laundering. Them in the SBC bank holding hundreds of millions of dollars to Iran and to the Mexican cartels. They're laundering money. Now these are people who go to work every day with suits and big offices, have chauffeurs and all this other stuff. And we see them, you would think that they would live on a higher level, a higher plane of thought process, because they're so detached that they should, that robbing and stealing would be the last thing on their mind because they have so much, but yet they're still not satisfied. So they have to concoct these wild structures of taking people's money in. Or they misappropriate their company money, and so they, for a short file, they feel like, well, we can go into their accounts and be stable for a minute, and we'll give them their money back. That's supposedly their intent, but it never works out that way. Now, now we can go all the way to the Ponzi scheme, all the way to the SNL.
Relationships don't work between black people. Racism, white supremacy is the reason.
Absolutely.
Can't get a job in the hood and you educated. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
Can't get an education in the hood because it's expensive. Racism, white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Poor education in the hood you live in. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
You live next to poor people who will rob your ass, steal and kill your ass because they don't have no options and they don't have no option to critically think. Racism, white supremacy.
Yeah.
And I see that that's a problem. So I wanted to just make a pimp decision.
$1 trillion flow.
$1 trillion
from L.A.
flow
to Miami.
Love, $1 billion.
dollar flow. A $1 trillion flow. We are able to have more money than the government, because we are the government. A $1 trillion flow coming from Egypt. Coming from the mother country, Africa, to New York and Chicago. The birthplace of Malcolm X. The birthplace of Martin Luther King. Duchamp. I'm talking about $1 trillion flow. The slave train. I'm talking about Paul Lawrence done by Robeson. The slave train. The $1 billion flow. You and me. Me and you. Poor and rich. We are rich because we're in the $1 billion flow. Yes, you can have that new Benz. Yes, you can have that Beamer. Yes, you can have that Rose. Yes, you can have that. Yes, you can have it up on the hill, up in New York, up in California, out in Oakland, Compton, L.A. You can have the $1 billion. Your health is 100%. You're 100% healed. You're 100% woman. You're 100% man. You're 100% up with your health. I'm talking about the $1 billion flow. We are right for getting what belongs to us. Give me what you owe me, and you owe me a $1 billion flow. I want what's mine. I want to have the best of life. I want the sun to shine on me. I want my fellas to wake up. People of color all over the world is in the $1 billion flow. Maybe you in Atlanta, Georgia. Maybe you in California. Maybe you in Texas. Maybe you in New York. Florida, maybe in Canada, between the $1 billion, maybe you're in St. Paul, Minnesota, or Indianapolis, Indiana, which might be $1 billion flow. It's going on up in New York, in Chicago, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, New Orleans. It's going on, the $1 billion flow. Down in Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Phoenix, Las Vegas, New York. We're calling for the $1 billion flow. I see you rise up and be brilliant. Say I'm rich because I'm in this $1 billion flow. I am the original man. I am the original woman. I must have my respect. I must have my education. I must have $1 billion. I must be rich. I must lift my brothers and sisters out of the ghetto and out of poverty. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Get what I want. Have what I want. I can get it now. Right. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Look at somebody. I'm in the $1 billion flow on my job. I'm in the $1 billion flow in my business. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Why don't you get in the flow of the billion?
God bless you tonight. This is $1 trillion flow. And $6 trillion was spent 20 years over in Iran. So we bought that. But we're talking about the storms and the floods down in New Orleans, down in Baton Rouge, all the way up to New York. We're praying, but we had prophesied they were coming back to back. That would have been said that. So get ready for a breakthrough. Get ready for God to deliver something to you.
this morning, remaining awake through a great revolution. The text for the morning is found in the book of Revelation. There are two passages there that I would like to quote. It's in the 16th chapter of that book. Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. I'm sure that most of you have read that arresting little story from the pen of Washington Irving entitled Rip Van Winkle. The one thing that we usually remember about the story is that Rip Van Winkle slept 20 years. But that is another point in that little story that is almost always completely overlooked. It was a sign in the end from which Rip went up in the mountain for his long sleep. When Rip Van Winkle went up in the mountain, the sign had a picture of King George III of England. When he came down 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the first president of the United States. And Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, but in looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountain, a revolution was taking place that at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through a revolution. One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change. And yet they fail to develop the new attitude, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. There can be no gainsaying of the fact that the great revolution has taken place in the world today. In the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. Then that is a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then that is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place. That is still the voice crying through the vista of time, saying, behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new challenges and new opportunities. And I would like to deal with the challenges that we face today as a result of this triple revolution that has taken place in the world today. First, we are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. And anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. The challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has come into being to a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance, place time in chains. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. But somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island in time itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls for thee. We must see this, believe this, and live by it. If we are to remain awake through a great revolution. Secondly, we are challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life. The vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle, sometimes not so subtle, the disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent and for America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. Everyone must share in the guilt, as individuals and as institutions. The government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact 11 o'clock on Sunday morning when we stand to sing, in Christ there is no east nor west. We stand in the most segregated hour of America. The hour has come for everybody, for all institutions, for the public sector and the private sector, to work to get rid of racism. Now, if we are to do it, we must honestly admit certain things and get rid of certain myths that have constantly been disseminated all over our nation. One is the myth of time. It is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. And there are those who often sincerely say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, why don't you slow up? Stop pushing things so fast. Only time can solve the problem. And if you will just be nice and patient and continue to pray, in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. Well, that is an answer to that myth. And it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm sorry to say this morning that I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme rightists of our nation, the people on the wrong side, have used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. Comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time and realize that time is always right to do right. Now that is another myth that still gets around. It is a kind of over-reliance on the bootstrap philosophy. And there are those who still feel that if the Negro is to rise out of poverty, if the Negro is to rise out of slum condition, if he is to rise out of discrimination and segregation, he must do it all by himself. And so they say the Negro must lift himself by his own bootstraps. They never stop to realize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. The people who say this never stop to realize that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. But beyond this, they never stop to realize the debt that they owe a people who were kept in slavery 244 years. In 1863, the Negro was told that he was free as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed by Abraham Lincoln. He was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. It was something like keeping a person in prison for a number of years and suddenly discovering that that person is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. You just go up to him and say, now you're free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get some clothes to put on his back or to get on his feet again in life. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. And yet this is the very thing that our nation did to the black man. It simply said, you're free. And it left them there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. And the irony of it all is that at the same time, the nation failed to do anything for the black man. Through an act of Congress, it was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, built land grant colleges to teach them how to farm. Not only that, it provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, the years unfolded, it provided low interest rates so that they could mechanize their farms. And to this day, thousands of these bad persons are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies every year not to farm. And these are so often the very people who tell Negroes that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. It's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. We must come to see that the roots of racism are very deep in our country. And there must be something positive and massive in order to get rid of all of the effects of racism and the tragedies of racial injustice. Now that is another thing closely related to racism that I would like to mention as another challenge. We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world. Two-thirds of the peoples of the world go to bed hungry tonight. They are ill-housed, they are ill-nourished, they are shabbily clad. I've seen it in Latin America, I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia. I remember some years ago, Mrs. King and I journeyed to that great country known as India. And I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to meet, talk with the great leaders of India, to meet and talk with, speak to thousands and thousands of people all over that vast country. These experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall linger. But I say to you this morning, my friend, there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes God's children sleeping on the sidewalks at night? In Bombay, more than a million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. In Calcutta, more than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population, more than 500 million people, some 480 million make an annual income of less than $90 a year, and most of them have never seen a doctor or a dentist. As I noticed these things, something within me cried out, can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no, because the destiny of the United States was tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation, and I started thinking of the fact that we spend in America millions of dollars a day to store surplus food, and I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge in the record stomachs of the millions of God's children all over the world who go to bed hungry at night. Maybe we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. But not only do we see poverty abroad, I would remind you that in our own nation, there are about 40 million people who are poverty-stricken. I have seen them here and there. I've seen them in the ghettos of the north. I've seen them in the rural areas of the south. I've seen them in Appalachia. I've just been in the process of touring in many areas of our country. And I must confess that in some situations, I have literally found myself crying. I was in Marks, Mississippi the other day, which is in Quitman County, poorest county in the United States. I tell you, I saw hundreds of little black boys and black girls walking the streets with no shoes to wear. I saw their mothers and their fathers trying to carry on a little Head Start program, but they had no money. The federal government hadn't funded them. They were trying to carry on, and they raised a little money here and there, trying to get a little food to feed the children, trying to teach them a little something. And I saw mothers and fathers who said to me, not only were they unemployed, they didn't get any kind of income, no old age pension, no welfare check or anything. I said, how do you live? They say, well, we go around to the neighbors and ask them for a little something. When the berry season comes, we pick berries. When the rabbit season comes, we hunt and catch a few rabbits. And that's about it. I was in Newark and Harlem just this week, and I walked in to the homes of welfare mothers. I saw them in conditions, no, not with wall-to-wall carpet, but wall-to-wall rats and roaches. I stood in an apartment. This welfare mother said to me, the landlord will not repair this place. I've been here 2 years. He had made a single repair. She pointed out her little boy who was the victim of lead poisoning. She pointed out the walls with all of the ceiling falling through. She showed me the holes where the rats came in. She said, night after night, we have to stay awake. Keep the rats and the roaches from getting to the children. I said, how much do you pay for this apartment? She said, $125. And I looked and I thought and said to myself, it isn't worth $60. Poor people are forced to pay more for less. Living in conditions day in and day out where the whole area is constantly drained without being replenished, it becomes a kind of domestic colony. The tragedy is so often these 40 million people are invisible because America is so affluent, so rich, because our expressways carry us away from the ghetto, we don't see the poor. Jesus told a parable one day, and he reminded us that a man went to hell because he didn't. His name was Diomedes. He was a rich man. There was a man by the name of Lazarus, who was a poor man, but not only was he poor, he was sick. Sores were all over his body. He was so weak that he could hardly move. He managed to get to the gate of Diabetes every day, wanting just to have the crumbs that would fall from his table. Diabetes did nothing about it. The parable ends saying, Diabetes went to hell, and there was a fixed gulf now between Lazarus and Diabetes. And that is nothing in that parable which says that Diabetes went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a rich young ruler came to him and he advised him to sell all. But in that instance, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. And if you will look at that parable with all of its symbolism, you will remember that a conversation took place between heaven and hell. And on the other end of that long distance call between heaven and hell was Abraham in heaven, talking to Diabetes in hell. Now, Abraham was a very rich man. If you go back to the Old Testament, you see that he was the richest man of his day. So it was not a rich man in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Diabetes didn't go to hell because he was rich. Diabetes didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. Diabetes went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never really saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Diabetes went to hell because he maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. Indeed, Diabetes went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. And this can happen to America, the richest nation in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. In a few weeks, some of us are coming to Washington to see if the will is still alive, or if it is alive in this nation. We're coming to Washington in a poor people's campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're going to bring those who have known long years of hurt and neglect. We're going to bring those who come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. We're going to bring children and adults and old people, people who've never seen a doctor or a dentist in their lives. We're not coming to engage in any histrionic gesture. We're not coming to tab Washington. We are coming to demand government will address itself to the problem of poverty. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty nor the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. We're coming to ask America to be true to the huge promise, glory note that it signed years ago. We're coming to engage in dramatic, non-violent action to call attention to the gulf between promise and fulfillment, to make the invisible visible. Why do we do it this way? We do it this way because it is our experience that the nation doesn't move around questions of genuine equality for the poor and for black people until it is confronted massively, dramatically, in terms of direct action. Great documents are here to tell us something should be done. We met here some years ago in the White House Conference on Civil Rights, and we came out with the same recommendations that we will be demanding in our campaign here, but nothing has been done. The President's Commission on Technology, Automation, and Economic Progress recommended these things some time ago. Nothing has been done. Even the urban coalition made up of mayors of most of the cities of our country, the leading businessmen, have said that these things should be done. Nothing has been done. The Kerner Commission came out with its report just a few days ago and then made specific recommendations. Nothing has been done. And I submit that nothing will be done until people of goodwill put their bodies and their souls in motion. And it will be the kind of soul force brought into being as a result of this confrontation that I believe will make the difference. Yes, it will be a poor people's campaign. This is a question facing America. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. America has not met its obligations and its responsibilities to the poor. One day, we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done. Yes, we will be able to say, we built gargantuan bridges to span the seas. We built gigantic buildings to kiss the sky. Yes, we made our submarines to penetrate oceanic depths. We brought into being many other things with our scientific and technological power. It seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough. But I was hungry, and ye fed me not. I was naked, and ye clothed me not. I was devoid of a decent sanitary house to live in, and ye provided no shelter for me. Consequently, you cannot enter the kingdom of greatness. If ye do it unto the least of these, my brethren, unto me. That's the question facing America today. And I want to say one other challenge that we face is simply that we must find an alternative to war and bloodshed. Anyone who feels, and there are still a lot of people who feel that way, that war can solve the social problems facing mankind, is sleeping through a revolution. President Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. The world must hear this. I pray God that America will hear this before it's too late.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my...
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty, and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shut down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes. All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation.